thanking the organizers. That's a little weird because I'm supposed to be on the organizing committee, but I swear I did a minimal amount of work, and my biggest task was deleting the emails that the organizing committee sent me. I read them first. So I want to talk about work of a group of researchers, which I'm going to put everyone's name on up right now. And I find this a really very interesting collaboration, and I'm enjoying doing this with them. So let me say, this is also, it's work funded by a variety of places, but in particular a focused research group of the NSF, and there's John Carter. Hang on, I'm just going to point everybody out. I can't find John. John Carter. Oh, that's me. That's Bernard DeConnick. Philippe Guyen, who I'm going to talk about his calculations. Joe Hammock, Diane Henderson, Dave Nichols, Harvey Seeger, Kathleen Soulem, who's our chair, and also Doug Wright, who will give the third talk today. This is Doug Wright. And a lot of support, including the Fields Institute for generous support, NSERC, the Research Chairs Program, which has been very generous, and the SharkNet, who have beautiful computers. So I'm a mathematician, so I usually like to put down, I prefer to put down the equations I'm going to solve. So I'm going to solve equations of surface water waves. In this talk, I'm going to try to work on the two-dimensional problem, that is, everything is constant in the third and horizontal variable. So my variables are x and y. Surface displacement will be considered a graph, at least for now. I usually make a joke about surf in California, but just imagine that. And its potential flow, which again is an approximation. And here are my equations. Standard kinematic and Bernoulli condition on the free surface and free slip boundary conditions on the bottom boundary. There are a few standard conserved quantities. Actually, there are more than this, but here's the one I want to talk about that will enter the discussion. Mass, momentum, and energy, which most people know very well. So let's keep these up. We'll try to be consistent with the transparencies. And I want to talk about the following type of evolution problem. So this I wanted to call a binary collision. So I'm going to do the following thing. On the surface, very far to the right, I guess at stage left, I'm going to put a solitary wave solution of the water wave problem. There's a depth, minus h, I forgot to say. And very far to the left, at stage right, I want to put another solitary wave. There's a one-parameter family, so I want to have those by S1 and S2. They could be the same, could be different. And that's my initial data, and I'm going to organize their velocities so they're aiming at each other. So, of course, it's not a stationary problem anymore, but it looks exponentially close, at least for a while, to two solitary waves propagating at each other. And then they come together and clap, do something violent, or do something quite energetic, and then they leave. And there's an S2 going over here, and an S1 going over there. And I remind you by saying it's S2 plus, meaning it might not be exactly S2. And S1 plus, it might not be exactly S1. And one of the things I want to do is talk about how those behave. How do their parameters change? And it could well be that there's a residual left behind. And I want to say that this happens on a fast time scale. That's counterpropagating waves. Counterpropagating is what I'll talk about most, and I just want to contrast it with co-propagating. And let me say that what I didn't say when I was introducing the characters in the plot, which is there are at least three, if not four, levels of consideration of this problem. I'm going to talk about the setup of the problem, because there are two talks after me who will also talk about the same subject, but I'm sort of mostly involved in numerical computations using Euler's equations, or our approximation to Euler's equations. You'll also see a wave tank and water's approximations to Euler's equations in our following talk. And after that, Doug Wright will talk about work of his and Gene Wayne on long wave asymptotic analysis of the problem. but thank you for the introduction. The co-propagating case, if they're both moving in the same direction, a taller one overtaking a shorter one, there's S1 and S2, and then they interact in some long time later case, there's an S2 plus probably changed, S1 plus probably changed, and a residual. And that happens on a substantially longer time scale. I'll discuss it further as we go along. So, what do I want to say about it? I want to say that the solitary waves are a one-parameter family. Sometimes they're called Stokes waves. So let's put this transparency up. This is my reminder to show something. So it's a one-parameter family of, I guess I sometimes call them Stokes solitary waves. And it looks like a branch. This is not a theorem. It's a theorem down here, and it's a numerical up there. And it might not be exactly right, but it sort of looks like that. What is a theorem are the green lines. I'm not so sure people know about this, but they're in velocity amplitude space. There are two parabolas and a vertical line, and the solitary wave branch has to sit in between those two parabolas and the vertical line. Yeah, it's of interest. I've just by hand sketched, so I kind of screwed this up, the scaling, but that means that when the Stokes extremal wave is when the red hits the parabola, and it has to hit above that point, which is H upon 2, which it says pretty high, and it has to hit below H, which is very high, and I guess numerically it's 0.83 something up there. And then I looked through the literature because I wanted to show, of course, a picture of solutions along that branch, and all these high-tech modern calculations didn't seem to just plot the profiles they were computing. So we went back to a Byatt-Smith and Longit-Higgins paper and proceeding to the Royal Society, and here's a picture of the solitary waves, some sample points along that branch. Okay, I'll leave this here. So now, what I wanted to do was show you some plots of solitary wave collisions. So let's go to the next one. This is a reminder to show me those plots, which is, this is what we're supposed to look for in some of the issues that occur in the counterpropagating case. So let's see. One is that these collide. Of course, when this is isolated from that by many miles, this is moving essentially at constant velocity, and then they interact and they hold together for a while. So this red line is my schematic of what the maximum does at every time step, and it comes together and then holds together for a while. And then they leave, and these go off and are asymptotic to straight lines. That also is not a theorem that they leave and are scattering waves. I'll talk about that. Well, I won't talk about that later, but that's an interesting mathematical problem. So if I draw this velocity, that makes a line, and I draw this asymptotically, that makes a line, and there's a phase shift. And of course, this is not the phase shift that we're very familiar with from KdV, because it has the other sign. And what the counterpropagating waves come together as they smack together, and they hold there for a moment, and then they go away. And a moment's thought says if they're holding there for a moment, they also are higher. So if I have amplitude A1 coming in and amplitude A2 coming in, then the amplitude in the middle is more than A1, A2. So that's called the run-up, that extra amount of time. And, of course, this delta theta is called the phase shift.
What kind of model?
Euler. Actually, we use three models. We use water in a tank. And then you push it, and you watch it go together. Experiment. And then we use Euler. I'm going to show you Euler calculations. Right now, I'm going to show... a computer is never exact. Converged. And then Doug Wright, in two talks in the afternoon, third talk in the afternoon, will have a KdV-like model with interaction terms.
And conversion is probably
nonlinear. A computer is converged in numerical convergence, spectral numerical convergence criterion, which means error.
Is it fully nonlinear?
It's Euler, which is a nonlinear as you wish it to be.
Which is
not a perturbation.
This is not a leading order calculation. It depends on what you mean by leading order, but it's not a leading order calculation. Integral equation. Okay, I am going to skip to the integral equations. And then I'll show you, what do you want to see, the pictures first or the integral equations? Integral equations. That's what we're trying to look at. And let me just jump to the integral equations. I'm happy for this. Yes. Which is here. Excuse me for getting confused. So here's the numerical method. And it's actually based on Sahara's ideas. So in a fluid domain, I have to solve Laplace's equation at every time step, imposing Neumann boundary conditions on the solid surfaces, and then evolving the free surface as per the kinematic and Bernoulli conditions. So what I think is an elegant way to do that is to write down Sahara's Hamiltonian, which is H is in terms of kinetic plus potential energy, where I've written down the kinetic energy. Sorry, I forgot to write down the potential energy, but it's just proportional to the L2 norm of eta, the surface deformation. And the kinetic energy is the Dirichlet integral for that harmonic function over the fluid domain, that is grad phi squared, 1/2 sum, that is integral over the fluid domain. I can rewrite that in terms of the Dirichlet-Neumann operator by integration by parts. So what I want to say is this G, I should use the pointer, shouldn't I? This G is defined by, if I let the function C be the boundary values of the velocity potential, then G is a linear operator on the functions C. So I'm going to do the following things. I take C, I take its harmonic extension to the fluid domain, which satisfies the bottom boundary condition. I then take its gradient, I take a limit as y goes to the surface, and I dot the normal to that surface, and for normalization purposes, I'm going to say d surface area, and that defines a linear operator g eta xi dx. It's linear in xi because I'm solving a linear equation for xi. It's quite highly nonlinear and non-local in eta, but nonetheless, there it is. And if I do that, and I put it into here, and I also do the proper potential energy, then I can rewrite all those equations of motion I had in my slide number one, which are harmonic functions, Neumann boundary conditions on the bottom, plus kinematic and Bernoulli condition in terms of a Hamiltonian system. That is, this is in the form of z dot is equal to j gradient of h, where the gradient of h is the xi derivative of h, which you can check yourself from here, and the xi derivative, so the xi dot is equal to minus the eta derivative of h, which has this interesting feature of involving the derivative of the Dirichlet-Neumann operator with respect to changes of the domain, a calculation which at its root goes back to Adamar. Where is the numerical scheme? You do the following thing. Oh, you base it on a theorem, or you could base it on a theorem. Way to introduce it, which is the Dirichlet-Neumann operator is an analytic object. It's an operator which varies in domain in an analytic fashion, as long as I take eta to be a Lipschitz function. That is to say, there's a Taylor series. But why don't I take my Taylor series, put it into the Hamiltonian, so here's H, as is written on the previous page, and now I expand G, and I get a series, H2 plus H3 plus etc., and I'm going to now approximate by truncating that series at some finite term, m. And I'm going to put that into the Hamiltonian system, and that will be my solution. To motivate it one more step, if I calculate g0, that's our famous d tanh hd, where d is 1 upon I d by dx. That is, if I took the Fourier transform, it would be k tanh hk, which is easy to implement on a computer using a spectral method, and pure multiplication. It's a spectral method on the surface. And if I do the following thing, which are a little harder but similarly straightforward, and G1, G2 as far as you wish, then you can write down this numerical approximation. Katrine and I wrote this down in 93 or before, and there are a couple of people in this room who are using this, including Paul Taylor, Dave Nichols, myself, and Philippe, and Katrine. That's an elegant method. It has its problems. Nothing is magic. But if you get it in the right regime where it converges, it converges very fast. That's our numerical method. This is in finite depth. In infinite depth, we unfortunately don't have solitary waves. So let me get back to what I wanted to do was, where was I? I wanted to show some of Philippe's most recent calculations. And let me tell you that these are recent because he delivered them to me Sunday about noon. We had an appointment about 10:30 to 11, and I think he showed up at 12. And this is my initial data. Oops, let me get it right. Which is like this over here, a bump and a bump, and they're aiming at each other. You can't see the velocity, but let me tell you, they're aiming at each other. And then this is them right at their maximum run-up. And one thing I want to say is those were 0.5, so A over H was 0.5, and now this is little under 1.2. I was sort of hoping it would be a little over 1.2, but it's a little under 1.2. And I'm afraid, sorry about that, it may be a little numerical instability that is going to affect us later on. But anyway, those are two profiles. I'm just going to run through a few slides just to show you how this looks. If I draw a space-time portrait of this, let me see, I'm going to put time equals zero on the bottom. And then here are the starts of those two peaks. And this is, the circles are a tracking of the peak of the solution. And those come in on two straight lines because they are solitary waves in all but almost pure solitary waves until they get very close to each other. And then this solid line is a line fit to the first piece of data, to the data just about to here. And then they interact, and then they go out. And the dotted line is a line which is fit to the last, I don't know, more sets of data, bits of data. It cuts off about here. And what I want to say is it looks pretty parallel here, which is something we want to consider in more detail. Oh, I should also have said the warning that these are the late breaking results, so they have to be taken as preliminary results. But I think I want to say in confidence, I want to introduce the topic because other people will talk about it, and I want to say, you know, say that hopefully we'll have a good shot at settling some of the mysteries with this. Here's a zoom into the peak. So here's the peak coming in. This little chatter may be just grid problems. And then these, by the way, we chose the peak. We chose left half and right half. So when there's one peak, it gets 2 points. Sorry about that. It's couldn't change it from Sunday to today. And then this is the outgoing one. So it has this particular picture there. So those are Euler calculations. And I wanted to... This is A over H is 0.5 coming in, so quite high. And just to give you a overall view of the side view of this, this is coming in, that's time equals zero, they come in and then they hit, and then they go out, and those are the exiting. And this, by the way, is the residual, which looks definitely real, but probably possibly small. The phase lags are small. They are small. I've had some discussions about the Boussinesq interval equation. So one thing about the Boussinesq is it has co-propagating solitary wave interactions, but it also has counter-propagating solitary wave interactions. But to quote a source of mine, do not believe those because they don't have any mechanism for interacting. So what I would like to do, if you use a second-order equation, then unidirectionality is snuck into it. So I actually want to use another version of Boussinesq, which Kelp and Bob Sachs and a few others have studied. But I don't want to talk about that now because my time is ticking. And I would say I'd rather look at that model. But to tell you the truth, those are long-wave models, and these at 0.5, these smack together, vertical accelerations are very high, and it's not so clear you are satisfying the hypotheses of the long-wave approximation in that. Yes, Paul?
People know that when they don't
interact, so you can almost do it by definition. I have more slides, but I've been distracted, so I'm going to spend my last 2 minutes getting to that. Okay? So one, just want to contrast with the co-propagating wave, which is when one comes in, co-propagating waves are moving in the same direction, a large overtaking a small. Let's do the sort of a non-intuitive thing and just put ourselves in the center of mass coordinates. So now the big one is moving and the little one is moving, they're going to hit right in the middle. And they exchange, they actually repel each other. And there's a positive phase shift, that is, this one pushes that one over and this one pushes that one over. And that's, but to get that wrong, I drew this wrong, I'm sorry. This was supposed to be out here. I was writing slides too late at night. That's wrong, but they repel each other. And that's to be in contrast with the counter-propagating case. That was co-propagating against the counter-propagating case. Now I'd like to just finish by showing two experiments where the data is all over what I consider all over the map, and I'd like to take and then I'd like to invite you to look at the next two talks, which are to discuss the matter and the prospects of our future work. Here's out of a paper of Maxworthy, the same diagram showing incoming, a wall, and reflected. And this is really a schematic. This is not data. And then his data on run-up is like this, with kind of a cloud of data. So what I want to do, what I think our goal is to do, is to fix a proper curve in there, starting, well, here's already A over H, 0.4. I want a proper curve to go well up there. Oh, this is twice the run-up, so it should go higher. And secondly, I wanted to show you Temperville's paper, which is a 1985 paper, where this is the phase shift, which I would say is hard to fit a line, hard to fit a curve to that data. And so as I'm running out of time, I'm going to have to stop right now. I'll tell you what I was going to say in my remaining minute of time, and that was, it turns out when two solitary waves interact, it's like particles, except particles, when they have elastic collisions, you know which mass is one and which mass is the other, so they don't exchange mass or anything. You take that for granted, and then you compute what they do after a collision by the momentum and energy, and it's well defined. Well, here you can also exchange mass as well as momentum and energy. And so, the theorem basically is, in an elastic, if there were elastic collisions of solitary waves, which I don't believe in, but just theoretically, suppose there were no residue, then you would have to have exact, it'd be like mechanics. The particle would have to bounce off of each other and exchange momentum and energy, as you expect. And if there were inelastic collisions, my only other result on this, if there are inelastic collisions, you can leave some residue. It has to be that the particle slows down. So even though those look like parallel lines, they may not be. And it remains to be checked on our MATLAB output to check the second and third digits of that slope. And the last thing I want to say is the residual, A to R, which is left behind as these solitary waves go together, it's interesting, it cannot be arbitrary. There has to be a relationship between mass, momentum, and energy of the residual. There's a delta mass, delta momentum, and delta energy, which are related. I should be putting this up because I'm just in my dying moments of my talk. And that I find interesting. So you're not allowed to have arbitrary residual. You have to have a relation between it. And that was in the following slide. I just put this up to finish. Is that relation is essentially given by the derivative of the mass, momentum, and energy along the curve of the solitary wave. And just to illustrate, if I look in center of mass reference frame, the momentum has to always stay zero, and therefore delta mass and delta energy are proportional to that mass prime as a function of the parameter divided by the energy prime as a function parameter. Or another way to say it is the energy, the derivative of mass with respect to energy. I should have taken the other ratio. Let me stop here since my time is up.